Good morning and welcome to this February 24th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on that later in the hour. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors, not only about their books, but about their writing process, creativity, craft, all of those important things. It's my pleasure to welcome two dear friends to the show this morning. The first is one of my great mentors and teachers, Mary Rakow. And in the second half, another amazing friend and writer, Suzanne Redfern, is sharing her latest novel, No Ordinary Life. So stay tuned for that. But first, Mary. Mary Rakow is the recipient of two Lannan Foundation residencies and a Lannan Foundation Literary Fellowship. The Memory Room was shortlisted for the Stanford University Libraries International Saroyan Prize in Literature, a Penn USA West finalist in fiction, and was listed among the best books of the West by the LA Times. She comes to fiction from theology. She has a master's from the Harvard Divinity School and a PhD from Boston College. She lives in San Francisco, where she is a freelance editor. The book this morning is This Is Why I Came. It's published by Counterpoint Press, and it's my huge pleasure and honor to welcome her on. Mary, hello.
Oh, hi. Thanks. It's an honor to be here, too.
Oh, it's so great to have you on. I've been waiting for this day for a really long time, so I'm so excited to do this. It's really fun. So before we dive into the novel, I thought, you know, it might be worthwhile to kind of set the stage in terms of your relationship with religion, because, you know, from what I know, it's a deep and complicated and certainly informs this novel. And so I thought maybe we could start with you talking kind of about what role religion played for you as a kid and how you came to study theology and kind of where you are today with it.
Oh, okay. Let's see. You're right. It is a long and complicated story, but I think I can just do the high points. I was raised by mom and dad, they're both deceased now. My father was a nuclear physicist and either an agnostic or an atheist. We never discussed religion in the home as a family. So I don't really know what the right label would be. But he never went to church. My mother was a very devout evangelical Protestant. That's a very major stream in Protestantism. And so we went to church regularly. She would take us. She was a musician, often played at church too. And so there was a great theoretical, you know, conflict between the two of them, which was never articulated, but very much felt, at least by me growing up. So my father would be teaching me about the periodic table and talking about Niels Bohr, and my mother would be encouraging me and helping me learn the prologue to John's Gospel. So I memorized a lot of scripture, but I also got with my dad this very fine sense of science. And, you know, we were hoping to go to the moon and all this kind of stuff. So there were these two systems of thought that were very, very architectural. They both attempted to explain the big picture in which I could find myself. And so that was kind of that was the question that I thought, I think, most about as an emerging thinking person. And that never really changed. So, let's see, where should I skip to? I became a Catholic at Harvard Divinity School. I graduated in the late 1970 and was married and was trying to think, what do I want to do with my life? Do I want to go to the Peace Corps? You know, what is the structure of meaning that I want to put myself into? And a religious studies department had opened at UC Riverside when I was a junior there, and I didn't realize that theology was an academic discipline or an ancient academic discipline. I sort of thought the Bible came out of heaven and dropped down, you know, fully formed. And that's kind of a distortion in the evangelical tradition. You can pick up, it's wrong, it's not really what they teach, but you can sort of have that notion. So I was really excited about that and decided I really want to study theology. It was kind of the larger of the two theoretical frameworks, and that it could really absorb science and was not in conflict with science and all that stuff. So I went to Harvard, and there I was exposed to reading things that were not in Scripture but were written very close to the time that the New Testament was, you know, formulated and codified and stuff like that. And I was really, really taken by the first centuries of the Christian community. So I became a Catholic. I just felt I didn't have reason to protest. So I sort of moved into the Catholic Church as a Protestant. So it wasn't really a conversion. It was just moving like some people would say, you know, you start with white wine and you move to red. I mean, it's like a logical, it felt like a logical progression to me for a lot of reasons. But anyway, and then I didn't want to go into academic theology. I wanted to lead a contemplative life. We had two kids and one on the way. Anyway, so that's a whole other story. And then I got very, very disillusioned with all language, including theological language, and moved away from the church for about 30 years. I'm just I'm starting to make my way back. So that's kind of the short answer.
No, that's a beautiful answer. And, you know, and I think all of this is sort of contained in the backbone of this novel in certain ways. All of this thinking, I feel like the book has become sort of a vessel for all of that. So that's why I wanted you to talk about it a little bit, because it's it really informs how I think the book is structured and put together. And I know you dislike summarizing your own work. I've read that you dislike
it. I'm not good at it. I mean, it's one reason I don't do book reviews or blurbs either. I just am not good at summarizing anything, you know. I either think, like, in detail, vivid, you know, microscopic or macroscopic, but I'm really bad at that kind of in-between, a very useful form of discourse. I'm just lousy at it. But were you going to ask me? No, I am. I mean, I am horrible at it.
I can't believe that's true, but I do.
Oh, trust
would
me,
love
it
for, but I would love for you to sort of take us into the novel in your own way and kind of introduce it as only you can, or maybe you want to introduce it as Counterpoint did, because they also did a really, really great catalog copy
for
the book.
Oh, yeah. I approved that. I didn't think it up, but yeah, that was good. You want to do that, or do you want me to? Well, what did they say? I kind of forget, but I liked it. We did that about a year ago, so.
Well, I'll tell you what they said, and then you can tell me what you think
Okay. Also.
So they said, a woman sits in prayerful meditation, waiting for her offer of her first confession in more than 30 years. She holds a small book on her lap, one that she's made, and tells herself again the Bible stories it contains, the ones she has written anew for herself, each story told aslant from Jonah to Jesus, Moses to Mary Magdalene. Woven together and stitched by hand, they provide a new version, virtually a new translation, of the heart of this ancient and sacred text. Bernadette traces through each brief and familiar story a line where belief and disbelief touch, a line that has been her home, ragged and neglected, that hidden seam. Which is a really nice description of the book.
Yeah, that's right. I did help with that writing. Yeah, I like that. It was, I mean, I think that's a very good summary of what the book is, you know. And it wasn't until I had finished writing it, which actually came very, very fast, which is so unusual, but that I realized it, because I was writing these stories for myself. I was just, you know, and then they were written, and I thought, maybe this is a book, you know, maybe I should send this to Jack at Shoemaker at Counterpoint. So I did. But, and then it was sort of after that that I realized that, because I've been reading about new atheism and things like that, I've been reading Sam Harris and Alvis Hitchens and people like that, because just to try to understand what was the motivation and things, and it interested me, and it's in our culture, especially a couple of years ago, I think it was even more so. But, so I realized that, you know, actually, this text has a kind of place in the discourse about belief and disbelief, or do you need a supernatural, you know, belief system to conduct an ethical life and teach your kids how to be good, you know, and things like that. So I realized it kind of has a place in that, and that actually each character is struggling within himself or herself this abrasion between belief and disbelief, which can be intellectual or it can be emotional, or, you know, it can manifest itself in many, many different ways, but that kind of abrasion, and that's actually always been part of probably every faith tradition. You know, that's why it's faith. It's not, you know, there's always this abrasion that is part of an embracing any religion, any system that does not include some degree of very lively uncertainty is not a system that appeals to me.
Right.
I'll put it that way.
Right.
They're always too small. You know, they're like too well-mannered and politically correct and small. And they don't have that radical bigness that always, you know, like science, you know, it has this huge, you know, radical acknowledgement of all that we do not know. And if it, you know, any system that doesn't incorporate that is not of interest to me. So actually, you know, I think it's pretty central to being a living person. You know, yeah. It is something that we all have, and that I don't think the lower life forms have that.
Well, and the book is just full of so many interesting juxtapositions of directly opposing things. You know, the woman, there's a story in here. So I should tell our listeners, the way the book is structured is well-known biblical stories. Even for somebody like me, who is pretty much a stranger to the Bible, I do know who Noah and Adam are. And so it has kind of the traditional stories, and then it's an imagining of the backstories of what these characters were really going through, or projecting forward in time what happens to them kind of in the aftermath of these stories. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think the basic assumption of the book, which I didn't do a forward or anything like that, but I just assume, and I did it as writing this book, and I have Bernadette, who's my stand-in, you know, that these are just, the people in the Bible are no different than people right now. You know, I don't think they are, and I also didn't get into the debate of, are these historically true? Did the flood really happen? I'm not interested in those questions. I understand the complexity of that debate, but it's not what interests me. I just take the stories as if they historically happened, and then take them at face value, and then imagine that the people in them have nothing, no edge that we don't have. You know, they're not smarter. They're not, you know, they're just us. So then, if you actually do that, the stories are really very interesting. I mean, I think if we can just remove this veil over the Bible, you know, like these people are really different, this is a different world, and just take it off and just assume that this is a story about something that happened today or something like that, or we are in that, we are that person, you know, then we are Abraham, and we have this deep, deep sense that our notion of the divine, however we describe that, is wanting us to sacrifice our own child, and well, you know, like that.
I was thinking, because I think I've shared with you that I, you know, my background in theology is really limited. I mean, I did go to Sunday school as a kid, but the Bible is really a very foreign book to me. But I thought, as writers, regardless of whatever your religious persuasion is, the Bible is a really important book to read, because it's, it's just a whole vast swath of cultural references. But
yeah,
I feel like it's sort of a mirror that you can hold up to yourself and see yourself reflected in all of these characters. And
I think so. Otherwise, I don't think we have use for it, you know. Yeah. I mean, when we enter a fictive world, you know, even if it has a bizarre premise, like a guy wakes up and he's a beetle, you know, for Kafka's world. But the reason that it means something to us, the reason it means something to us, is that we enter it with ourselves, and we, you know, we forget, you know, that I actually live in San Francisco, and it's really, you know, 2016, all this stuff. You know, you enter another world, and you accept, in good writing, you accept all of the rules of that world, as bizarre as they may be. You know, you enter it, and I think good writing does that. It sort of teaches you how to read itself, and it also gives you a world with its own rules, and those are not the object of the aesthetic experience. They are grounding the aesthetic experience, and you go into it and you have an encounter with yourself. I think that's exactly right. I think that's why we have art, and why we need art. That's why we need Mozart. That's why we need Picasso and Motherwell. You know, I mean, we go into them and we see ourselves. It's not, we're not conscious of that, and we may not formulate it that way for many, many years, or we may never formulate it that way. But I think that's what art is. You know, is that throwing out of a net by one person, say Motherwell, and then you look at, you know, his 50th elegy to the Spanish Republic or whatever number it is, and he has thrown out this net, and then you find yourself caught in it like a fish. Mm-hmm. And it's that collaboration, I think. Otherwise, you know, he wouldn't be hanging right now in the De Young Museum, you know. You know what I mean? There's something that's the validation of the experience. I think that's right.
And we should say that your God in this book is not a simplistic, all good, all nurturing, all benevolent God. I mean, he's very complicated.
Right.
He has sort of a broad spectrum of human emotions. So it's
I've had readers say that he's their favorite character, or some will say, I like all the characters but God, you know. And I think those are both really fun reactions and stuff like that. But actually, if you look at the scripture, say you look at the story of Noah and the flood, I mean, some would say, well, it's a myth that accounts for the observing of a rainbow after rains, and what is that about? I mean, you can work through that approach to it. But in the scripture, the story is he makes this rainbow to remind himself to never destroy creation again.
Hmm.
I mean, so there's this contrition, So he makes a covenant with Noah, a promise again to never do what he has just done. So I didn't really make up God, repenting, and all of that, I have to say, is a way of playing with the idea that in English we label with three letters, G-O-D. That is a very far remove, a very, very oversimplified version of what I personally, would, I don't even like talking about the other as named or with a face or anything like that. In terms of my own personal spirituality, it just immediately shrinks the divine down to something that is not complex and interact compelling enough for me. But in this is Bernadette, and she's made this book, and in that limited scope, I very much just thought seriously about these aspects of the portrait of God that are biblical, they're biblical. Yeah. And there are other images of God too, of course, his omnipresence and his mercy and all those things. But I kind of like the idea of, God has a question, God struggles also. I didn't do this intentionally. I only saw it after I finished the work. But God also is struggling with belief and disbelief. And his issue is, am I merciful or not? Because really, if we look at, to me, my reading of a lot of these biblical stories is a story about a God figure struggling with being merciful and wanting to be known and worshipped as a loving and merciful entity with whom which a person can have a relationship. And so, yeah, it's I was exploratory in that way. We kind of took great liberty, but I don't know. I mean, I just, so it's a little smaller sense than my own, I'm very, my own sense personally as a person, but as an author and in the person of Bernadette, I put it very much down in that way, that we are created in God's image. That ancient notion means that there are these resemblances. So we could say, well, then, God has delight, and God wants to be worshipped, and God wants our attention, and God wants our gratitude, and all those things, which is a very anthropomorphic way of talking. So it's paradoxical. I mean, it's a valid way of talking, and it has an ancient tradition, but it's also not the complete. It's not the only way of talking, and equally important is the very ancient tradition of silence.
Mm.
That God is unnamed, that God should not be made an image, which we have very strong in Islam, Mm. And so there are all these things that are held all true at the same time that are essentially paradoxical. God is the most intimate, has the hairs on our head numbered, which is biblical, and then God who is beyond all speech and beyond all envisioning and like that. And I think that if we dissolve that paradox and just go with one side or the other, it's a great impoverishment,
It's an ambitious novel. It would be hard to contain something so complex in, 200 pages.
Yeah, I know. I finally wrote a short book. I always wanted to.
And it's so beautiful. I do want to give you a chance to read to us, because I feel like we're depriving our listeners of kind of understanding all that we're talking about here. And I feel like the best way to do that is for you to just read a couple of pages to us. Can you do that?
Oh, sure. Did you want? I think you and I talked a little bit. Maybe the Adam one.
Yeah.
I don't know how long that takes me. Let's see. It's the first chapter.
That's
three pages long. Is that the right length for the program?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so this is chapter one. It's called Adam the Maker. He fashions peacock, dove, and parakeet, all the species and subspecies, microscopic and immense, yet is unable, no matter how hard he tries, to make the form he longs to see, the song he hears but cannot put outside himself, unable to compose the right sequence of notes, unable to make the form that will tell him who he is. He traces his hand, his foot in the sand, lying on his back, reaches over his chest with a stick, traces his entire body there, then stands, but it does not move, unable to make a form like himself that also breathes. The water erasing it like an encouraging teacher at first, saying, try, try again, then mocking. Destroying this drawing and that, all around the island in the wet sand and dry sketches and more sketches, pages and messy piles under the trees, floating on the lakes, clay models on the riverbanks, countless mud statues, all of them false. Fabricated, then abandoned, revised, fabricated anew, then abandoned again. Clumsy or elegant, it doesn't matter. The debris is everywhere, and the animals are multiplying faster than he can keep up. All of it not what he wants to see. He cannot find a way to put outside into the world the form he cannot not see, bound by this need more visceral than if his legs were bound by leather straps tight on his body, digging in. If he walks to the left, it is there. If he walks to the right, it is with him, this formless thing demanding a form, and he cannot get it right, draft after draft after draft. We had such high expectations for you, he hears the waves say. Sometimes he thinks it is the chorus of animals, donkeys and macaws, jealous that he is not satisfied with him. Why are you despondent? The robin asks. Look at my wings. And the ant, look at my diligence. And he does look, trying to preserve what is left of hope, and does study his companions that are his successes and so near. But this does not solve the problem and brings no peace. Out of respect, he has given all of them their individual names, zebra, koi, antelope. But the real name for each, the name he keeps to himself, is not me. You are not me. You also are not me. It is endless, the diversity of what is not me, a torment. So that finally at one sunset, at the close of one particular day, the remnant of hope impossible to revive, he denies his desire. Denies whatever it is that pushes him to transcend who he is, to exceed all the animals and the plants and the stars, the sea and the dry land, all that he has already made, even though it is all, and he knows this, which is a mystery and confusing, that it is all undeniably good. He imagines instead the pleasure of not being driven, and so formulates a different end to his loneliness, and, taking the sharp blade, lies down thinking to end his life. It seems dignified, a gate to relief, perhaps even to happiness. But when he lifts the blade over his abdomen, he fails again, unable to pierce himself, as if failure were endless, as if failure itself is what he is best at inventing, and finding that he lacks the necessary courage, falls asleep, hoping to never wake. She comes to him in a dream so startling, it wakes him, and he sees that she is not a dream at all, but is as real as the field mouse, the ostrich, the hen, and hawk. For a long time, they stare at each other without speech, motion, and he compares her to the elegance of the serpent and imagines her softness like the goose's down, seeing that she is unlike the other creatures he has made. He thinks her name will not be Not Me, but perhaps not me, yet seeing that she is equal to himself, does not name her at all, but asks, what is your name? And she replies, Eve. He wonders from where she comes, wonders, since he has not made her, if there is a maker mightier than himself, one who, by implication, holds him in a deep understanding, his hunger clearly and intimately known by this other, as it has now been made visible in its answer, which causes him, as he stares at her, arm and leg and neck, to wonder if all the creatures in the sea and on the dry land and all the stars in the heavens that he thought he had made weren't made by him at all, but rather by this other. And he desires to know this one and names the maker he cannot see, but whose work he sees, God. Mm. That's the end of it.
That is gorgeous. That is gorgeous. That was Mary Rakow reading from her latest novel, This Is Why I Came. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I wanted to get into this whole discussion of language because I feel like it's so integral to the novel, that kind of the naming of things and the losing of the, there's a line in the story about Noah where they're losing the language when they're on the boat. And sort of the importance of language as affirmation to Isaac, and, you know, givings of color and the naming of color and the naming of animals and the naming of things. And I know this is such an important thing to you in your own, you know, I mean, you're such a wonderful poet and so beautiful with language.
Thanks.
So how much of, you said you weren't thinking about this too much when you were writing it, but I find that hard to believe.
Well, I don't. I think it's just, I mean, it was very much in my heart, you know, but I don't think that the book came out really, really fast. But I have to say it was, you know, 10 years of trying to do, that's just like, no, I mean, just like Adam, you know, draft after draft after draft. Yeah. I mean, that was my experience. So that's why that fragment came out really fast. And then there was this turn at the end about being, you know, being known and so on, and maybe he wasn't the maker and all that stuff, which came as a surprise to me as I was writing it. It came out just kind of fully formed, but it came from my frustration and stuff like that at not being able to get this novel, the second novel, off the ground for over 10 years. Mm. Anyway, so then I thought, oh, he has this sense of some greater one who knows him intimately and names that God. And then I realized when I did that that was, you know, my first fragment, like I say, and I was interested in what we have achieved as human beings in many, many fields, in science, in the law, in design, in politics. You know, we have developed notions and we have developed language to name those notions. And it's a profound accomplishment, and it sets us apart from all of the other creatures, you know, all the other life forms. And I have a deep, deep regard for that. I have a deep regard for the law, the dream of the law, the dream of the major religions that we've come up with, you know, that we've formulated, all that. And language is a way of fastening our achievement, fastening onto it so that it can be transported, you know, to another person in another century and things like that. Mm. The language is really, really important, and it's very biblical, you know. I mean, God creates in the Genesis account, creates the created order by uttering it. And then Jesus, the primary name, or one of the primary names for Jesus is, you know, the Word with a capital W. So James, you know, the fourth gospel, John's gospel, doesn't talk about the birth of Jesus in the manger or anything like that. It's that Jesus is understood as the Word that preexisted in entering space and time and was always present and through whom all of creation occurred. So that's the language and utterance is really, you know, very crucial to a biblical understanding of the world. You know.
I could listen to you talk for years. I love all this.
Oh, well, 35 other questions. I could talk for years. That's a bad thing. I mean, my kids will get on me like, Mom, okay, less detail. Come on. Cut to the chase, Mom.
I love it. And it's killing me that we're drawing down on our time. It's killing me that we had problems with the phone at the beginning. But any last words of writing advice? What sustained you over the 10 years that you were writing?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that if you don't have to write, don't bother. Because, you know, it's probably not, you know, I mean, I think people that write, that can write, you know, you do it because you get from it some ordering of chaos in your own thinking and stuff, and you create something outside yourself that you're carrying inside yourself, and you don't find it anywhere in the world yet, so you make it. And that's true if it's a sculpture or a concerto or, you know. And I think I'm very, very influenced by Motherwell, and I love his work so much. And there's an amazing film called "The Storming the Citadel," which is about Motherwell and the other abstract expressionists. But you know, he did over 500, you know, attempts to fix his notion of the elegia for the Spanish Republic, and never really getting it right. And then he said, but maybe I did get it right. I just haven't recognized one of them is the right thing, you know. And he wasn't bitter about it. It's just that he was trying to preserve something that he thought would be, you know, would not be remembered. That was very beautiful. So I think that I don't think you can. It's not endurance. Like, oh, I want to be a writer, and so I'm going to. I never had that ambition myself. I want to be a writer ever. You know, I still don't have that ambition, but I'm trying to understand something that I can't not try to understand. And that's what I think we should pay attention to. I mean, that's my advice to writers. Like, maybe one is to be a writer, but maybe it's really biology that is the right discipline. I mean, we just have to find out what is it that, like my son reminded me that I said to them when we were young, what's the thing you think about when you're driving in a car? This was before, you know, devices that you could read stuff on, you know, there was nothing. You know, what is it that you think about when you're stuck on a family trip and you're riding, you know, for 50 miles in a car and you're staring out the window? What are you thinking about? And that's where the life work should come from, that, because it's distinct to each person. And when we go into whatever it is that is distinct about our trouble with the world and our curiosity about the world, then we will make something that really is beautiful and meaningful, and it can be, you know, a mathematical theorem that is finally, you know, proven, or it can be the design of a beautiful coffee cup, or it can be, you know, a novel, or it can be theology, or, you know, it can be anything. Yeah. But I think that's my principal concern with working with writers, is what is the thing without which they cannot live happily? What is the enterprise that is worth their devotion? Yeah. And finding that enterprise is a great, can be a very long journey. I didn't start writing until I was almost 50, you know. So I just wasn't fitting into the other things. I still don't. I don't know why I'm a writer. It's just I can use language, but I'm not mostly influenced by literature. I'm mostly influenced by architecture and visual arts and stuff.
I love it. We're gonna have to get back together so I can ask you the other 30 questions.
Well, yeah, I know. I mean, I think you were right about naming it. It's really important, and I forgot about the Noah in the Noah fragment that they lose language. I totally forgot about that. Thank you for reminding me. I mean, that's the thing, you know. You learn so much about your work from the other, from you, from any reader, really completes the work. Yeah. You know, so the novel is just my gesture.
Yeah.
And then, but it's not the handshake yet, you know. And
right.
So,
yeah.
Thank you for reminding. Yeah. If we talked, I would mostly be learning from you about you, but also learning about, you know, what I have made, because
it is
a conversation. Totally possess it.
Yeah. Right. Oh, Mary, thank you so much for this. This was really wonderful.
Oh, this was really fun, Marie. I'm really glad that we were able to do it.
Me too. Okay, hang on, and I'll come right back on. But that was Mary Rakow. The book is This Is Why I Came, and you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Suzanne Redfern will be on for the second half hour. Stay tuned for that. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes or under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. A couple of very quick literary announcements that are happening around Orange County and LA that are notable. If you are a fan of The Book Thief, can you believe it's been out for 10 years now, and it is being commemorated with a re-release, which includes a new jacket and bonus materials. More importantly, Marcus Zusak is going to be in Orange County Tuesday, March 8th at 7 o'clock p.m. at the Norman P. Community Center in Mission Viejo. You can look that up online. And, of course, Literary Orange is coming up. AWP is coming up. So all of those things, if you are a writer in Orange County or L.A., I highly recommend you check out. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Suzanne Redfern, my dear friend, is here in the studio with me. She is the author of Hush, Little Baby. She graduated summa cum laude from California Polytechnic University, and prior to becoming an author, was an architect. She's an avid surfer, golfer, skier. She is a huge Angels fan. She lives with her husband in Laguna Beach, right down the road from me. Orange County locals will know her husband's restaurant in Laguna, the Lumberyard, where I reside most every week. And, No Ordinary Life is her second novel. Suzanne is right here beside me. What a huge treat. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you, Marie. Thank you for having me.
So in the interest of full disclosure, I'll tell our friends and listeners that we met in Barbara DeMarco Barrett's workshop a number of years ago. This is before Hush Little Baby. This is certainly before No Ordinary Life. I don't even remember the year, but it had to be like 2004, 2005 or something.
It was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago, right? So sort of take us quickly through your evolution as a writer and sort of, you know, when and how you got into it, how you decided to leave architecture and kind of where you were in the process when we hooked up.
Well, you know, I really didn't start out with any ambition to be a published author. It was very much a bucket list endeavor. Everyone always says they're going to write a novel, and I thought, well, shoot, you know, I had some downtime. Architecture wasn't doing so great at the time. It was during the recession, and I thought, I had this great idea. So I started writing, and 7 months later, I had my first very poorly written manuscript, and I kind of fell in love with this world of storytelling, and I thought, you know, not only did I enjoy it, but I thought if I'm going to do this, I want to learn how to do it right. So that's when I got into Barbara's workshop, and I bought every book I could find on writing, and I cleaned up the manuscript. And again, it was really a bucket list endeavor. It was just for myself to see if I could do this. And a friend who had been in the literary world kind of, she read it for me. She read it and she goes, you should send this out. And so sure enough, I sent out the query letters and I got such positive feedback. And I thought, you know, I just really like telling stories. And so I just kind of continued down that path while still being an architect. And, you know, eventually Hush Little Baby made it into the world. And I've got to say, I think I found this kind of hidden, I always compare it to music. You know, there are musicians out there. I've always wanted to, like, be a rock star, but I actually have, like, zero musical talent. And no matter how many lessons I take, no matter how many times I try, it's just not in me. And I feel like storytelling is something that is in me. It's this kind of weird gift that I've discovered, and I love it. And so I'm going to continue down that path. And that's kind of how it ended up. And now I'm in this world, and architecture is still something I love, but authoring and writing books is what I do.
Actually, I think there's a really interesting intersection between architecture and novel writing, but I'll get to that in a minute. The other thing that I wanted to pick up on is I heard you talking recently about the difference between being a good writer and being a good storyteller. And I think that's a really important distinction to draw. I really struggle with storytelling. It comes very obviously naturally to you. I love writing, and I think I'm a decent writer, but putting beautiful sentences together is not telling a compelling story. And so I kind of want to get your thoughts on how you know you're putting together a compelling story, and when you know you're not, and a project should be abandoned, like when you know a story has enough legs to carry you.
Right. I do really believe storytelling is something that's almost innate. And there's this great segment on TED by Elizabeth Gilbert where she talks about genius as being not genius within you, but genius as this kind of exterior force that kind of you channel through you. And I feel like sometimes when I'm telling stories, that's almost what it feels like, almost as if I'm a conduit for these ideas that are coming out. And yes, there are definitely false starts where you'll start writing, you're going, this is just terrible, it's just gobbledygook, it's da-da-da-da. But usually my stories start with a larger idea. So like Hush Little Baby was this idea of the evil and good within us, and then how you can turn that on its head, or how you can make evil look good and good look evil, and then what would compel somebody to go the opposite of what their nature is. And so when you start with a big idea like that, it's a little easier. I think the story kind of gets honed in because you're constantly driving towards a bigger idea that you had. And the same with No Ordinary Life. I started off with this idea of what celebrity does to a person and how it affects them and the people around them. So that's a much bigger idea than just a plot. And then the plot somehow finds its way through this idea that I'm exploring. And like I said, I wish I had a better answer that the writers out there that are listening to this could go, oh, that's how you do it. But it is almost like this magical thing that kind of happens. And always it ends up being around 400 pages. And I'm always very pleasantly surprised. And I'm like, oh, look at that. It all wrapped up into this nice little package. But yeah, I do believe. And then, but to address that a little further, one of the things that I think great storytellers often struggle with is they still have to be very good at their craft. And you have to have both. You could be the greatest storyteller in the world, but if you don't know how to weave that into a compelling vernacular, nobody's going to want to read it. And that's where my first book, you know, obviously I wrote this book and I was like, wow, look at that. All those characters are so cool and the storyline's so cool. But, you know, I didn't write well. And so nobody's going to want to read that either. So you need both. But I do believe that it's much easier to learn how to do the craft than it is to learn how to be a storyteller.
No, that's right. That's right. And I do think it's really helpful to communicate to writers that starting with kind of big philosophical questions is easier than, you know, the smaller story.
Well, unless you're a genre writer. And I, you know, I just taught a workshop for a writer's conference. And if you're a genre writer, you know, go get that book. It's called Save the Cat. It kind of gives you your plot points. It kind of says, this is where it's all going to fall apart. This is where it's all going to come together. This is where the moral's announced. And it kind of tells you what pages these things are supposed to happen. That's a great way to write a first novel or, you know, to do a plug and play kind of thing. But yes, if you're trying to write something that's a standalone, mainstream, different kind of novel, definitely having a big idea to work from gives you just so much more to pull from in order to find that inspiration and to make those characters deeper and also to make your readers care. Because why are they spending 15, 20 hours reading this book? Hopefully they walk away with some thoughtfulness from it.
Yeah, right. And I do think there's a relationship between architecture and novel writing. I mean, and building big structures, you are obviously able to hold big ideas, big structures, I don't know, big buildings in your head. I do think there's a real link between the size of a novel and the size of a building.
Absolutely.
Putting it together.
It is definitely a marathon. It's not a sprint. I mean, you got to know what you're in it for. 6 months, 7 months, even a year. Some novel is 5 years to write a novel. So the lady you were just talking to, brilliant. You know, it took her 10 years to kind of figure out what it was she was trying to say. So, you know, it's definitely long-term. And architecture is like that, too. It starts off very overwhelming. But, you know, you just put one thing down on the page. And, you know, architecture has just lent itself so well to, surprisingly, there's so many parallels. But this idea of allowing, when I used to do architecture, I'd approach it the same way. I'd kind of just let the terroir, which is a winemaking term, it means the essence of the site, dictate what the building was going to be. And in writing, it's the same way. The story wants to be what it wants to be. And you have to, again, allow that to grow organically. You have to allow your characters to come to life. And they kind of dictate then what is going to happen. And again, that architecture and the author, they definitely have some parallel lines in how you approach it. And like you said, just the kind of having that faith that eventually you're going to be able to master this giant, overwhelming thing that's in front of you.
Right, right. So let's get into No Ordinary Life a little. I know Hush Little Baby and Ordinary Life, No Ordinary Life, and I've read sneak previews of the one that you're working on, all surround mothers trying to protect their kids in very different ways. And it seems like I'm trying to figure out if that's a theme you found or if you found that theme or if that theme found you.
That theme found me. Hush Little Baby was my fifth novel, but it was the one that made it through the gauntlet of the publishing world to actually make it into into, you know, the actual world. And, you know, to new authors out there, this is my advice, is write, because you don't know what's going to hit that magic formula. It's not that the other four novels I wrote weren't as good as Hush Little Baby. It's just that for whatever reason, this is the one that they thought was going to be able to make it, you know, sell books. And so, you know, that went out there in the world. And it's actually very much a psychological thriller, but they positioned it more family drama. And then I wrote another novel and it didn't quite fit that category. And so they said to me, you need to write one that's more like your first one. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is branding. I need to work within these constraints. And so then I'm, you know, I wrote No Ordinary Life, which is another mother protecting their children. And I thought, oh, see, they like this. And then, of course, I colored outside the lines again. I wrote one that wasn't in the box again, and that one didn't get published. And now I'm writing a new one that's in the box again, which is Mother Protecting Their Children. And, you know, everyone's excited about this. And truthfully, if I'm going to be branded, Mother Protecting Their Children is a great topic. There's so many books I can write about that. So I'm actually very thrilled that is my brand. And, you know, at some point down the road, who knows, maybe these other novels will make it out. But if not, writing it's an art form. And like I said, if genius strikes or inspiration strikes, I think you have to grab onto that, the tail of that tiger, and hold on and go along for the ride, because otherwise you're missing out on some wonderful things that who knows where they'll lead.
So that's interesting that they're sort of dictating to you what they want you to write. Like, could you write under a pen name Mystery Thrillers if you wanted to?
Yeah, I suppose you could. I mean, it's very hard to build your brand anyway, so I'm perfectly happy with, you know, again, building up my readership. And, you know, again, this is a great topic. I don't mind writing these novels. But, you know, the artist side of me is like, if I have this other inspiration, I definitely don't want to let that go either. And, you know, it's a very inefficient way of doing it, obviously. But luckily, I don't take that long to write novels. So I'm still able to keep up with, you know, putting out the novels that they want me to put out. And, you know, again, it's a business. You're not going to stay in this if you don't realize that really early on, that, you know, the publisher's trying to make money and they're trying to make you successful, and branding is part of that.
Right, right. Okay, so take us into the world of No Ordinary Life a little bit, kind of where the idea germinated, the big idea is mothers protecting their kids, but a totally different spin than Hush Little Baby.
Right. So, again, I'd written a novel that didn't get published or didn't get picked up by my publisher, and so I knew I had to write mothers protecting their children, and it seriously took me less than a day to come up with. You know, once I was focused on what I needed to do, I was standing in the grocery store and there was a tabloid with a headline that said Zac Efron enters rehab again. And my daughter had been a huge fan of High School Musical when she was little. And so, you know, like so many people, I felt like I'd watch Zac Efron grow up. And my heart kind of broke for him. I just, you know, thought, oh my gosh, you know, here's another child star or another young, you know, former young actor that's struggling out there. And to be honest, I felt for his parents, too. I'm like, you know, it's just heartbreaking. He's around the same age as my son, and it broke my heart. And I thought, that's the story, to figure out what is going on behind the glitz and glamour that's causing so many of our young actors when they become adults to struggle. And that's where it came from. And then I, like I said, I did it kind of like I do architecture. I dove in and started researching everything I could find on celebrity, everything I could find out, every autobiography I could find from a young actor. And that really allowed my brain to kind of start going. And again, the story kind of came to me after that.
That's fantastic. I love it. My guest this morning is Suzanne Redfern. The book is No Ordinary Life. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So there's a big cast of characters in the book, and you kind of have to follow all of their through lines. And, you know, they each go through their own evolution, their own changes. And so talk a little bit about keeping all of those strings alive in your head and, you know, pulling, you know, there are kind of some minor characters. I don't want to give too much away about the book, but there's, you know, kind of the John Hinckley character. So so talk a little bit about kind of keeping track of all of these characters and kind of what your process looks like when you get it all down, and then what?
Yeah. Oh, it's so funny. Anyone uses the word process, I have to laugh because it sounds so organized, and what I do is so not. It's so chaotic. I don't write chronologically, which is bizarre to a lot of people, but again, because I'm doing so much research, I'll have an idea here and I'll have an idea there, and I'm like, oh my God, I've got to write this. Oh, this has to happen. And so again, you know, when you get that strike of lightning, you definitely have to put that down. So that's really, you know, process, like I said, doesn't really work. And probably to write this 400 pages, I ended up with 800 pages. And then I whittle it down. I go, okay, this is where these strings tie together. But I don't know. I don't, you know, again, that's just such a strange question, because even now, like, I reread the final draft before it went to print, and I was like, wow, where'd that come from? I, you know, sometimes, like, the twist with Griff, I was like, wow, that was just seriously, I have no idea where that came from. But except for to say that because this is all mulling around in your brain, somehow there's this other subconscious that's working beyond you that is kind of figuring it all out. And then, you know, magic happens.
Isn't that magic? Yeah.
It is. It's just magic. And you're like, wow, look at that. That's so freaking cool.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, when you get those little insights, I mean, it's so what were the big stopping points in this novel in terms of, you know, if there was a mess and how you back yourself out of it and get out of it? Like, if you say, oh God, you know.
I think the big problem with this one was it was so ungainly. It was just, there were so many different ways I could have gone with it, because obviously celebrity, there's all kinds of corruption that's happening in all different ways. And so that's why the book ended up being 800 pages that had to be whittled down to 400. I'm like, where is the actual story? These characters, I'm just talking about these characters, because I could have told a whole book just on the John Hinckley angle of it. I could have told a whole book on, you know, just the one child's angle of it. And so, you know, you have to, again, this was the mother's story. This is her protecting her child from this world, and to kind of keep bringing it back to Faye, who's the protagonist, and what her journey is. So that was probably the biggest struggle with this story.
It struck me as, I mean, if you set it up as what the character wants and then putting obstacles in their way, and, you know, at the beginning, what the character wanted was money. She needed money to keep her. I mean, there are a lot of ways to protect your kid, right? You can financially protect them.
Right.
And, she had a sort of, not disabled, but she had a special needs child that she had to protect. So that's one way to protect. So then you you solve that problem. And then there's another, you know, but the way you're solving the problem gives rise to other problems.
Exactly.
So I thought, you know, if you can set a novel up for writers as saying, you know, want, obstacle, desire, you know.
Absolutely. And, you know, you love your character, so it's a little hard to do it because you don't want to hurt them. And yet that's really what your job is as a novelist, is to constantly, like, make their life more and more difficult so that tension just rises and rises. And you still have to have sympathy for that character. You know, Faye had to be a sympathetic character. She couldn't be a mommy dearest. She, you know, otherwise no reader's going to care about her story. And she really is. She's a gullible, naive young mom who's trying to do the best for her family and finds herself in this world. And, yeah, then you're right. I just piled it on.
At some points, I was thinking, maybe she's an unreliable narrator. You know, when they were building a case against her, I was like, maybe she's not who we always thought she was. But that, you know, yet another way you could twist the novel into
exactly. And we're not all perfect. I really don't believe in writing, you know, flawless characters at all. And I don't believe in writing fully evil villains either. I mean, in this book, there really isn't a true villain. I guess you could say her ex-husband, but even he turns out to be, you know, human in the end.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's the reality of any antagonist or protagonist is we're all flawed.
Right, right. And that's the interesting thing of writing from the first person point of view, is you're getting this, you're getting Faye's perspective on her ex-husband, which
right.
is going to be very unique from other people's perspective on her ex-husband.
Exactly.
The other thing I thought was really interesting was the dialogue. So you have the kind of secondary main character is 4 years old, and she's, you know, talks like a 4 year old. And in the book, she talks like a 4 year old. Was dialogue something that you struggled with, finding these voices, finding how the kids talked? One kid doesn't talk hardly at all.
Yeah.
You know, at the beginning,
selective mutism helps. You know, the kid's mute, so he doesn't talk. So dialogue on him was pretty easy. But as far as the other characters, you know, again, you know, I feel like it's kind of how an actor or an actress must do it. I get inside their kind of minds, and I'm like, well, how would a four-year-old, you know, say this? And she's a very precocious four-year-old. Like I said, I read every autobiography I could find, so I had a lot of insight on Jodie Foster. I had a lot of insight on Michael Jackson and Shirley Temple. And so Molly kind of became this kind of hodgepodge of those characters, and I just kind of, you know, channeled them as far as when she was talking. And then, yeah, I'm talking in first person, you know, present tense when I'm writing this novel, so I was very much in Faye's head.
I love it. I
yeah.
love it. Time goes too fast, right? So there's another book coming, I know.
I'm working on that final draft. That's why I look very tired today.
I love it. Any last-minute words of writing advice?
Just sit your butt in the chair. Write. Honestly, the more words you put on the page, the closer you're going to get to publishing.
Yeah. I should point people to your website because there's, first of all, you keep up a kind of a really neat blog, and there's a great video. There's the 6 steps to writing a novel, which are hilarious and true.
And also, you know, I just want to point out a lot of manuscripts that I see from new authors, they're not formatted correctly. So as a tool to writers, I did put on a manuscript template that I created, and it is correctly formatted. So if you are writing a manuscript and you just want to make sure you're doing it right, there's a manuscript template that you can download from my website.
Yeah, that was super nice of you.
Oh, thanks.
That was very nice. Are you making any appearances around Orange County or LA?
I am. I'm doing Seaside Gallery on Saturday from 1 to 3. It's an author tea. I'm doing it with Susan Meisner and Ann Gerard. It's all about Hollywood and books on Hollywood, and it should be a really nice event. So if you're around 1 to 3 in Newport Beach, Seaside Gallery.
I love it. Sadly, that is all the time we have for today. Today went particularly fast. I don't know why, but when I'm with my friends, it goes particularly fast. So stay tuned for a little music program coming up next, and we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.